Welcome to Recovery Talk on AM 600 The Answer. Recovery Talk is brought to you by The Refuge, a healing place. The Refuge is a leading treatment center for men and women struggling with trauma, depression, and addiction. Listen today as our expert staff educates you and guides you in the areas of addictions, depression, and trauma so you can be better informed. To be a part of the program, call 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255. Now please welcome the Refuge Expert Staff Members. Once again, the Refuge Expert Staff Members.
Hello and welcome to Recovery Talk. We're here every Sunday evening from 4 to 5. I'm Heather Muha, Professional Outreach Representative with the Refuge, a healing place, and your host for this evening's show. Did you know that adults over the age of 50 are particularly vulnerable to addiction, to drugs and alcohol? Well, tonight we're talking about this life-threatening epidemic affecting our baby boomer population. But first, we're going to talk about something a little lighter, how body language can affect how others view us and how body language can affect how we see ourselves. If you'd like to join our discussion, we'll be taking your calls throughout the show at 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255. Give us a call. Our first expert guest tonight is Josh Pittman. Josh is a licensed mental health counselor who has worked at The Refuge for a little over 4 years now. He's well-versed in trauma resolution, sex and love addiction, and co-occurring disorders. Josh firmly believes in producing an atmosphere conducive to healing, where our clients feel safe, so that they may address the traumas in their life and hopefully overcome their addiction. Josh, thanks for being with us this evening.
Hey, Heather, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right, thanks. So, Josh, it's well known that the mind can affect the body, but you talk specifically about the way the body affects the mind. How does that work?
Well, a little while back when I started working with the Refuge and I started noticing how, many clients were coming in, and it seemed like the more we got the body moving, the more resolution we found. And, with trauma, the way that the body stores trauma, it's very important that we get the body kind of integrated into the treatment itself, into the therapy. And by doing so, there's certain things that actually how it impacts the mind in many cathartic and very therapeutic ways.
So how does the body store trauma?
Well, it happens on a visceral level. I truly believe that, because we have our many senses, sight, touch, sound, smell, taste, all of these are present when trauma occurs, and we have a tendency to kind of store trauma in that manner. So, oftentimes when we have somebody that's a survivor of sexual assault or maybe even, car accidents, which, a lot of people are survivors of those, the person can typically recall what they were wearing possibly or the sights and sounds, just previous to the accident or even in the moment, the smell of gasoline or burning rubber, things like that. And so those things can have a tendency to even become triggers later on down the road. So what happens is now, when they've recovered either physically or somewhat emotionally from the traumatic event that occurred, just a burning, something burning that smells like rubber or maybe even fueling up a car with gasoline and catching a hint of that can cause the body to kind of go back into this traumatic state, which is, kind of post-traumatic stress disorder is related to. So with that being the case, that's certainly the way that our body is impacting the mind. And so when I started doing the work with the clients, I noticed a great value in getting the body incorporated into the healing process as well. That way, the body could begin to feel safe again.
How do you even begin to incorporate the body into that healing process?
Well, there's several things. Recently, I spoke on the benefits of breath work and the benefits of other physical activities such as Tai Chi and Qigong, along with exercise, dancing, yoga is another big one. And there's lots of research out there on those primarily done by a lot of different people in our field, but one that I find fondly is Bessel van der Kolk talks about the benefits of yoga and how his psychomotor therapy came from even that of dance. So showing where those type of modalities really begin to release healthy, positive chemicals into the body and into the mind, and therefore helping to create some trauma resolution, to create the trauma loop, so to speak, because oftentimes we get stuck in our traumas.
What do you mean by that, getting stuck in your trauma?
Well, many times, I mean, if we take the situation of a car accident, especially if it's severe enough and, you know, somebody could be even literally stuck in the car, not able to kind of free themselves, and so they're depending on others. And then you take that a step further where maybe they're actually laying on an operating table and they're conscious of mind, but they're not able to really do anything. So, again, kind of the trauma starts to get locked up in the body and stored in the cells viscerally, and there's no way to necessarily let it out. I mean, as far as talk therapy is good, and it's very powerful, and Van der Kolk would back this up as well, it's very powerful to be able to share our stories with other people. It's also very powerful to find others that can empathize and know how we feel and really be there for support of us, but it still doesn't let the body know it's safe. So in many ways, we haven't, you know, covered all the bases, so to speak, when it comes to trauma resolution, if we're just talking about it. And that's where the becoming physical with yoga, breath work, and other things like that becomes so beneficial.
And becoming present in the moment, correct? Because oftentimes the mind is either in the past or going toward the future, and helping to stay present. Does that have anything to do with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those triggers that we talked about where smelling the gasoline or even burnt rubber, that has a tendency to many times throw a person back in, not necessarily, it's not like time travel, but it certainly has their body thinking they're back in a time and a place when they were, you know, either literally stuck or, you know, felt like they could not escape or their life was put at risk for death or danger. So, yeah, absolutely.
And what, give us one exercise that you do with the clients that maybe our listeners can do at home just to exemplify how the body affects the mind.
Well, I think probably the one that I would talk about, and I've talked about it most, is where a client of mine was a survivor of sexual abuse, and we had an assignment it's kind of a common assignment where we have them write a letter to their abuser. And, you know, as a result of that, like I said, that's the talking portion of it, which is good, and the clients in the room that are part of the group, they kind of step up for support. And then what happened with this particular client, though, is he became highly activated, and it was manifesting physically. And when I asked him what he wanted to do, they basically said they wanted to break something. And in order to keep them from, you know, destroying the office, I had some wood that was designed specifically for this type of process, and I picked it up, and we started breaking the wood, very much like a karate kid would, you know, break wood. And through doing that, it was enabled us to incorporate all the senses again back into the room that probably were all present whenever he was suffering the trauma. So, you know, the sound of the wood breaking whenever he hit it, the actual feeling of his fist making contact with it, the smell in the air as a result of the wood breaking as well, and certainly there was visual cues all over the place. And then the only one I'm not sure about, which I can't confirm for this person if this was true for them, but I certainly could taste, you know, the smell of, like, taste like the sawdust in the air.
Back to Recovery Talk in just 60 seconds.
The Refuge, a healing place, is a leading treatment program for men and women struggling with addictions, trauma, and co-occurring issues such as depression. The Refuge is nationally renowned for working with its clients to create real, long-term recovery. With their caring staff, you begin to unravel the underlying causes of your issues and gain the strength to accept and overcome them. They take a unique trauma-aware approach to treating addiction and co-occurring issues that emphasizes holistic treatment of the mind, body, and spirit. Their safe private campus is located an hour north of Orlando in Ocala, Florida, and features residential and outpatient treatment as well as drug detox. You can call them for a free confidential consultation, 866-612-6610, or visit their website, therefuge-ahealingplace.com. Welcome back to Recovery Talk on AM 600, The Answer, brought to you by The Refuge, a healing place. The Refuge is a leading treatment center for men and women struggling with trauma, depression, and addiction. To be a part of the show, call now, 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255.
Hi, and welcome back to Recovery Talk. I'm Heather Muha, Professional Outreach Representative at The Refuge. Before we went to break, we were talking with Josh Pittman, licensed mental health counselor at The Refuge, about the body's impact on the mind. Josh, you were just telling the story about the client you had in your office that was activated and dealing with some anger issues and how you helped by bringing out that board to help to break it and to incorporate the sense of smell, the sense of taste, isn't that right? Sense of touch within that moment to help him release some of that trauma energy. Continue on with that story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my hope and my agenda in that whole activity that we did with him was to really see if we could incorporate all those senses again. I'm quite positive that those senses were involved when he suffered his trauma. And like I said, when we broke the board, the only one I'm not really sure if he experienced, I know I can speak for myself that I certainly experienced the actual taste of the wood as it broke, just because of how you could smell the sawdust in the air, too. And being that those two senses are so closely tied together, the sense of smell and the sense of taste, like I said, it was something that I very much could identify. Whether or not he could, he'd have to speak for that himself, but it certainly was, it appeared to be cathartic, and then a couple weeks passed, and then he also informed me that it was something that he really got a lot out of, and it was the turning point for him when he was able to really start processing and resolving the trauma in a more healthy way than what he had in his past. So.
Sure. And, of course, we're not suggesting all of our listeners go out there and start breaking a bunch of wood.
No, of course not. No, Definitely some caution to heed in that area. I mean, it's not something, I don't know that I would do this with every client, even with anger issues, because certainly you have to know your client, and you have to know your own self as well, and safety has to be the foremost priority as well. I mean, in our field, it's do no harm, so.
Important, very important. Well, Josh, there's a specific type of body language and that I'd like to ask you about, and that's power posing. What does power posing mean?
Well, it's actually something I'm pretty excited about. I've come across this within the last year, and it's something that I wish I could take full credit for, but I can't. And I certainly would give credit where it's due, which is with Amy Cuddy, who's she's the head of the Department of Social Psychology at Harvard University. And they started looking into this whole theory around, like we were talking about today, of like we know the mind affects the body, but can the body affect the mind? And looking at how it does it from a scientific perspective as well. So several of her people got together and started exploring this and running lots of research. And I find it quite fascinating. And I've been able to do some of my own field research with that as well by implementing this with several of my clients, especially those with lower self-esteem or maybe levels of depression, things like that. And it's been quite fascinating to see what kind of results you get out of it. So, what it is is taking a look at body posture and seeing areas that where maybe we have posture of low power versus posture of high power. And so in my working with clients, lots of times they come in, those with low self-esteem and depression, they come in and they typically have low power posing in their posture, which would be more of a legs kind of drawn in, maybe a hand on the neck. I mean, they basically look like they're trying to be as small as they possibly can be, which is also kind of a result of the traumas that maybe they've been through. So, in working with someone like that, what I like to do is have them pick a pose that they see fit as a power pose, a high power pose. And they're going to consult with me as to whether this fits or not. And it's something that needs to be deemed appropriate that they can do for 2 minutes in the morning, and then I ask them to do it again for 2 minutes in the evening before they go to bed. So simply 2 minutes in the morning, 2 minutes at night. And to watch the results as a person actually starts to become more physically aware of themselves and how their body language is, and then to watch the impact it has on their self-confidence and things like that too is quite remarkable.
So what is a, describe to us what a power pose would look like, or a couple of different ones that you have seen your clients display.
Well, the most common, or the one that was actually on Amy Cuddy's video, they dubbed it the Wonder Woman, which is a pretty easy pose to strike, whether you're alone in private or even in public, which is nice because you can be doing this even whenever when nobody will even know. And the Wonder Woman is essentially hands on the hips with the chest, or the shoulders back, the chest out, the chin up, and, you know, breathing full breaths in and out, because that's an important part of it too, just to engage that diaphragm on a full full-time rate and as it's designed to do. And so doing that for 2 minutes and just basically taking an inventory of self, of the way you felt before and after. And with the clients I've worked with, what I've found is that they don't typically notice immediate results. It's not something that they think, oh, well, I feel like 100 times better than I did before I started doing this. But over time, what they start to see is they start to become much more aware when they're not in a high power pose or when they're exhibiting low power. And then they correct it, and then they're able to notice an immediate difference in the way that they feel.
What's a low power pose, Josh?
I'm sorry, what's that, Heather?
What's a low power pose?
Well, like I said earlier, a low power pose would kind of be like the head hung with the feet drawn in. Maybe if they're sitting on a couch, their feet would be drawn in almost like in the fetal position. So that would be probably the best way to describe that for the listeners. You know, being in a fetal position like that is very much low power, whereas a high power would be more of taking up space and kind of exhibiting a bigger physical silhouette. Another example, aside from the high power pose that I already gave, is one that's dubbed as pride, and it's like that of, say, a track star that crosses the finish line, and, you know, they have their hands up in the air, and it kind of exhibit, you know, exhilaration or like I said, pride. And those that are even blind tend to do the same thing when they cross the finish line within, you know, Special Olympics and things like that. When they feel pride, they throw their hands up, and that also is another example of high power.
I'm picturing, and this is just me being silly, but I'm envisioning, like, walking into a stressful situation with both of my arms up in the air, just like, yes, I can do this. Maybe not so appropriate for everything.
Right.
Right, yeah, and no, I know you actually do the Wonder Woman, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I do the Wonder Woman, absolutely. I like it because it's so ambiguous, and you don't know. You know, anybody could look at me and they wouldn't know I was doing anything to increase my self-confidence or self-esteem. I mainly do it before speaking presentations and things like that. It is something that, you know, speaking is a difficult thing for many people, and I have anxiety like the rest of the people out there. So before I do them, I typically go through my own rituals, but power posing was one of them. And to be able to stand in front of a crowd, even in the middle of my presentation, and maybe put my hands on my hips with my chest out, my shoulders back, and my head up, and take some deep breaths is very, very helpful to get through the presentation in a manner that I need to.
Almost invigorating in a way, and I can see how it would other people would observe you as being powerful. But power—that's what it means. It's a power pose, and so you suggest clients do that in the morning and then at night, just practicing that so they get used to feeling their body as it would be in a powerful position rather than not. Now, do you is there scientific research out there that actually shows that affects your brain's, the chemicals within your brain, to actually make you more confident, make a person more confident?
Yeah, absolutely. There certainly is. I mean, in Amy Cuddy's video, and I encourage any of the listeners to watch the video. She's a great speaker. Amy is a normal spelling. Cuddy is C-U-D-D-Y. Watch that, and they'll talk about it in more detail about what I'm fixing to say. But what essentially the power posing has the possibilities of potential to do is it can decrease cortisol levels, which is a stress hormone, and it can raise testosterone levels. And that's where most of their research has been focused on. I'm guessing that, you know, the further the research and the more that people dive into this such as this, that they're going to find even other benefits and other hormones and things that are being released in a positive manner. So when in power posing, if you're able to hold for 2 minutes, then you're giving your body a higher level of testosterone. You're lowering your cortisol levels, which are only going to help you throughout your day. And it's only 2 minutes a day. It doesn't take long at all. It's something that I suggest for even people that aren't dealing with low self-esteem or even depression. You know, anything that maybe the way to start off your day is get up, do 2 minutes in the morning. You can do it in the shower or then, you know, at night, 2 more minutes at night before you go to bed. And it's a good way to kind of begin and end the evening.
Yes, I love that idea. That's a great tip, Josh. I've heard you also in the presentations that you have done that I've been a part of, you do an exercise with the audience, and I was wondering if you can do that with our listeners now. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I'm not quite sure.
Okay, I'll do it with them. The one where you slump down and do
all the... Yeah,
go ahead. Walk us through that one.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, any listeners, of course, be safe on the roads and don't do anything that would cause you to take your hands off the wheel. But, you know, just kind of find a decent, comfortable sitting position and then slump your head, slouch your back and shoulders, and just sit real kind of hunched over and then try to be happy. It's kind of an oxymoron. It's virtually impossible to do that, to feel happy while you're sitting in that position. And then the reverse of that is, after a couple minutes of sitting that way, the reverse of that would be to now kind of stretch out with the chest out and the shoulders back and the chin up, and then try to feel happy and notice the difference of those two.
Right, it's so much easier. And there's a big difference. I actually just did that while you were talking about it. And at the refuge, in any clinical setting, I would think you have to be cognizant and you have to be aware of the body language of all of the people, especially in a group situation, in order to read almost, it is essentially what the person is feeling on the inside, their body is showing it. Have you found that to be true?
Absolutely true. I think that many times not that the client will be lying to us with their mouth necessarily. I mean, they may be trying to tell us the complete truth, but their bodies are going to tell us a lot more than what their mouth will. And oftentimes, you'll have trauma survivors tell you that this is what happened, and they kind of tell it to you like they're reading the newspaper, and maybe even with a smile on their face. But really, what's happening is if you notice any other extremities or things like that, you may see some tremoring, or maybe a foot is tapping, or something like that. Maybe just a twitch of a limb or something, and it can sometimes indicate that there's more going on. They may be saying that everything was fine, but at the same time, if we take into consideration the posing and the posturing, they may say everything was fine, have a smile on their face, but yet they have their arms crossed around their stomach as if they're holding their internal organs. And being that area is like the vital area for life, it kind of indicates that, you know, maybe not everything really is okay, despite what they're saying. And so it's obviously, or most of the time anyway, it's a cue to kind of dive deeper with that client to see, well, this is what I hear you saying, but what is your body feeling right now?
Right, because they're perceiving, even though they might be thinking the mind, the body is perceiving a threat. And so you're saying it instinctually just goes to protect all the vital organs, the heart, the stomach, everything, the intestines that are within the gut area. And I've heard studies done about that area specifically on how we hold trauma there, and how when people, they cross their arms or we had a clinician that said that she liked to put a pillow across her stomach. That's how she felt most comfortable or most safe when those perceived threats. Do you remember that?
I do. Absolutely do.
Yeah.
It manifests in many different ways, but oftentimes, you know, especially with traumas that we do hold on to or that we get stuck in, that tends to be the area that we hold on for sure.
All right. Well, Josh, thank you so much for being with us this evening and for sharing your insight on that mind-body equation. And I love the challenge for all of our listeners to try that power posing 2 minutes in the morning and 2 minutes at night and see what effect that has on your life and success. So thanks again, Josh.
You're very welcome. My pleasure, Heather.
All right, well, coming up, we'll discuss why an increasing number of older Americans are struggling with substance abuse. That's right.
News, traffic, and weather. Always informative, keeping you connected, updated on the stories that matter. We've got you covered. AM 600 is the answer.
CBS News Update. I'm Gary Nunn. President Obama's ready to explain his ISIS battle plan.
I just want the American people to understand the nature of the threat and how we're going to deal with it, and to have confidence that we'll be able to deal with it.
The president on NBC's Meet the Press today says the plan will include military, diplomatic, and economic components. Maryland's Dutch Ruppersberger, ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, says that Mr. Obama realized in retrospect it was time to get tougher on the Islamic militants.
I think the president made a mistake when he did not come out as strong after we had an American's head cut off, not one, but two. At that point, we should have, I believe he should have stood up and very strongly said, we're not going to take it, we're going to come after you, and we're going to bring you to justice.
Florida Republican Marco Rubio says that the president's plan must include airstrikes in Syria.
If you're serious about defeating ISIL, you have to go after where they're headquartered.
Rubio and Ruppersberger were on CBS's Face the Nation. The president will address the nation on Wednesday. CBS News Update. I'm Gary Nunn.
I have a question. Who handles the plumbing, HVAC, industrial, carpentry, and welding for large and small commercial buildings?
That's easy. You're talking about mechanical contracting, and the leader in Florida is W.W. Gay. W.W. Gay has been a licensed contractor for over 50 years.
Well, what about energy management, and who turns off the lights and AC on the weekends?
That's called building control automation projects, and yes, 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 you name it, when it comes to commercial, industrial, and engineering, W.W. Gay self-performs all services. HVAC, plumbing, piping, welding, carpentry, general contracting, steel erection, concrete, and temperature control.
I thought I recognized the name. I see W.W. Gay trucks everywhere.
W.W. Gay's expertise includes successful project completion within the public, private, and military sectors. Check out the projects they've done and call the leader in Florida, the name we can trust, W.W. Gay Mechanical Contractor, Inc. Online at WWGMC.com or by phone at 904-388-2696.
AM 600 and FM 100.3. You want the latest traffic and weather? We've got the answer.
Already 4:33 on this Sunday afternoon. AJ Davis with your traffic and weather together. And we have a few problems out there to report. Right now, 95 northbound in Duval County. We've got a problem here. And it looks like we're on the south side of Jacksonville, not too far from Old St. Augustine Road. Also, I-10 westbound at that same area. There's a mile marker 333 in Glen St. Mary. Just happens to be a similar mile marker on I-10. Beach Boulevard eastbound, east to a northbound Beach Boulevard, St. John's Bluff Road. There's been a problem there. Also a crash blocking the road, I-10 eastbound. The on-ramp to 295 northbound on the west side. Partial roadblock in the curve there. And also you're going to find some problems in Baker County, State Road 2 at County Road 127, part of the road underwater. Mostly cloudy, periods of heavy rain possible. 76 in Jacksonville now at AM 600 and FM 100.3. The Answer.
Welcome back to Recovery Talk on AM 600, The Answer. Brought to you by The Refuge, a healing place. The Refuge is a leading treatment center for men and women struggling with trauma, depression, and addiction. To be a part of the show, call now, 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255. Once again, The Refuge expert staff members.
Welcome back to Recovery Talk. Again, I'm Heather Muha, professional outreach representative at The Refuge and your host for this evening's show. More than ever, older adults are at risk of developing addiction. Joining me to discuss this hidden epidemic is Brenda Iliff, executive director of Hazelden in Naples, Florida. With more than 20 years of experience in the addiction field, both as a clinician and as an administrator, Brenda brings strong clinical experience into Hazelden's real-life recovery setting. Prior to her career as a chemical dependency professional, she worked in management positions in centers with older adults. Brenda received her bachelor's degree in gerontology and chemical dependency and went on to obtain her master's in counseling. She is also the author of A Woman's Guide to Recovery and travels across the country presenting on addiction and its impact on women and older adults. Brenda, thank you for being with us this evening.
Topic to talk about, and one that a lot of people don't even want to hear about, so I commend your listeners that are still on the line. Thank you.
Thanks, Brenda. Well, I read a statistic that it's estimated 70% of all hospitalized older persons and up to 50% of nursing home residents have an addiction issue, alcohol-related problem, prescription medications. So why now the spike in addiction for older adults?
Well, some of that is because the older adult population is increasing and people are living longer. But a big piece of that is because availability of other drugs. Remember years ago, we didn't have all the drugs available for sleeping aids or for anxiety aids or for pain aids. And so just like those drugs have really impacted the younger population, they've also impacted the older population. We're also getting better, too, at knowing what questions to ask and how to identify. I mean, the stats you talked about are really good. I've seen stats higher than that. I've seen stats a little bit lower than that. But, you know, as we age, our body metabolizes alcohol different. So the same person who's drinking actually, honestly, the same amount all their life, that alcohol is going to start to have a different type of effect on them as they age. And that can be as young as 50, but it can be also older. Also, as we age, a lot of times people might have episodes where they need surgery or have health care concerns. And so they're exposed to maybe pain pills, maybe even on a short-term basis. But you add that pain pill to the one or two drinks that they've had all their life with no problem. And then you add the metabolism slowing down. So those one or two drinks are really like four or five or maybe six. And then maybe there's problems sleeping, so you take a sleeping pill or an over-the-counter. We know that 83% of people over 65 use prescription pills, but of those people, they purchase over three-quarters of the over-the-counter meds, and there's a lot of over-the-counter meds. We call it the medication generation. You know, these are folks who are used to getting pills, and unfortunately at this point we're seeing a lot of folks misusing prescription pills.
Yeah, and the baby boomers, it seems they present different criteria that drive them to addiction. What are some
Absolutely.
Of the most common issues?
Well, and very good question, Heather, because when we talk about older adults, people generally think of the older adults. But when we're talking at Hazleton Naples in Florida about older adults, we're talking about people 50 and up, because that's when the metabolism changes. That's when the reaction to chemicals starts to change. And the boomers are very, very different than the traditionalists. You know, the older adult, they're more likely to follow the rules. They're more likely to have tons of shame about being in a treatments program. They're more likely, if they've lived, you know, many years as a very high-functioning person, have a lot of shame about being an addict, or even confusion, like, how could this happen to me? Recently, I had a man in group, and it was his first outpatient group, and he said, I'm 61 years old. I have no idea how I got here. I used to run businesses, and he was a very accomplished man. And we see a lot of that with folks who are older, but the boomers, they're very different than the traditionalists, that are going to follow the rules. And, you know, some of the traditionalists, their grandparents or their parents maybe even were back in the days of Prohibition, and they may have lived through those days, you know, so they've got a whole different concept of using alcohol and the word alcoholic. But the boomers, they used illegal drugs years ago. You know, they were the ones that were born during were active during the Vietnam War, during the time of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And they're going to be using illicit drugs much more often, and they're going to be less concerned about the shame of it because they used them in the past.
And it was socially acceptable.
Absolutely.
When they did that, I would think that there is also a bit of a stigma for that generation in asking for help, kind of like the
get over it or walk it off. Pull it up by your bootstraps and figure it out. No wonder they have so much shame walking into addiction and actually surrendering to the fact that there might be a problem, and they in fact are powerless.
Mm-hmm. Especially the older folks, not the boomers, less likely so. The folks, you know, when we talk about the different age groups, we have what we call the young old. Those are the folks that maybe are, you know, 50 to 70, maybe even 75, but they're functioning very well. Their health is generally pretty good, and they're pretty independent. And then we have the old, and those would be folks maybe 75 to 100, maybe even older. And generally they have more physical problems, less independence, and probably more health problems. But you know, Heather, you've worked in the addiction field and clearly even in the trauma field, that sometimes we see a 45-year-old woman who's really better to fit in the old group because of her health being poor, her independence being poor, her functioning being poor. So, you know, it's not necessarily about age. It's really more about how you doing in life,
Yes, and what stressors for both populations, as you mentioned, the young, old, and then the population that's even older, what stressors can lead to addiction in older adults, and how are they different?
Well, what we know for anyone over 50, they're because of the way they metabolize alcohol and other pills, that can be a real risk factor for leading to addiction. Other things is they may have multiple diseases. They may be seeing multiple doctors. You know, we're in the age of your general practitioner sends you to a specialist for everything. Well, do those specialists all know what you're taking from other people? They may have pain problems, which for any of us, you know, the especially people who may have struggled with addiction early on, but then something happened in life and they really didn't struggle for many, many years. We've seen some older folks who had years and years and years of 12-step recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, solid recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, and due to pain issues got hooked on the pain pills. And sometimes the pain pills led them back to the alcohol, and other times the pain pills just brought them down without the alcohol. As people age, they may have sleep problems, whether that's because of menopause or whether that's because of stress. Or a lot of times we see folks, especially as structure decreases in their life, they may take an afternoon nap, and then they wonder why they're waking up during the night for 2 hours. Well, you know, the sleep rhythms get off. They may be self-medicating. People also share medications. I mean, it's real common for folks to say, oh, you got a bad ankle? You know, my doctor gave me this pill, and off they go and running. There's also concerns around, you know, for the older adults, they may be taking their pills as prescribed, so they think, but their vision may not be so good. So they may be mixing up the green and the blue pill. Or they may have trouble understanding exactly what meds do I take once or here or there. Or they may take them twice in a row, and then all of a sudden their judgment starts to go. And then they're taking them twice again because I forgot I took them. Or they may have trouble opening the pill bottles. So, well, I can't get that green pill bottle open, so I'm going to take two of these pink pills. And it just really can snowball really, really quickly. Another concern is as people...
Oh, Brenda, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll hear more from you. Hold that thought after the break.
Back to Recovery Talk in just 60 seconds.
The Refuge, a healing place, is a leading treatment program for men and women struggling with addictions, trauma, and co-occurring issues such as depression. The Refuge is nationally renowned for working with its clients to create real, long-term recovery. With their caring staff, you begin to unravel the underlying causes of your issues and gain the strength to accept and overcome them. They take a unique trauma-aware approach to treating addiction and co-occurring issues that emphasizes holistic treatment of the mind, body, and spirit. Their safe private campus is located an hour north of Orlando in Ocala, Florida, and features residential and outpatient treatment as well as drug detox. You can call them for a free confidential consultation, 866-612-6610, or visit their website, therefuge-ahealingplace.com. Welcome back to Recovery Talk on AM 600, The Answer, brought to you by The Refuge, a healing place. The Refuge is a leading treatment center for men and women struggling with trauma, depression, and addiction. To be a part of the show, call now, 904-222-TALK. That's 904-222-8255. Once again, The Refuge expert staff members.
Hello and welcome back to Recovery Talk. Again, I'm Heather Muha, Professional Outreach Representative at The Refuge. Joining me to talk about older adults and their risk for developing addiction is Brenda Iliff, Executive Director of Hazelden in Naples, Florida. Now, drug abuse among Americans age 50 and older has risen sharply and dramatically in recent years. Brenda, with characteristics of an aging family member, which can include shaky hands, a lapse in memory, and just as you were talking before the break, perhaps the eyesight not being so clear as it used to be, it may be difficult for family members or friends to recognize the signs and symptoms of alcoholism or drug use. So what are some things that we should watch out for specifically in the aging population?
Well, your point is well taken that a lot of times the symptoms of substance abuse mimic medical symptoms. So it could be many. I mean, we really need to have the medical professionals involved also, because it could be shaky hands. It could be a diabetes is getting out of control because they're drinking so much. It could be lapse in memory. Well, that could be dementia. That could be the drinking. There's so many areas that the medical concerns mimic addiction concerns. And generally in our population, we say, well, it's medical, and we go for the medical. And that's why we're seeing a lot of folks, like you said earlier, in hospitals or nursing homes, because they're being treated medically, but the cause of that medical concern really isn't being looked at. It's very difficult for families, because a lot of times families are far away, you know. Mm-hmm. They're living in California, and they come in 1 week a year and see mom in Florida. And mom's pretty put together then. Oh, she might be a little bit different than last time they saw her, but, you know, I mean, things to look for might be is when you talk at night, are the words a little more slurred? Are they starting to forget things? A lot of times the people that really know what's going on might be the person who hauls out the garbage. Their doctors might know, but you might have six different doctors giving six different types of pills. It could be the person that does their hair. It could be the home health aide that comes in and really sees what's really going on. You know, looking for the environment. His mom, who was always really neat, is she really messy now? One of the things we see with older adults is what we call nesting. Nesting is that chair that, you know, they don't move from a lot, where their remote's there and their books are there and their iPad is there and their glasses, you know, both glasses, by the way, the reading glasses and the drinking glasses. And just like with anyone with addiction, as we move more and more into addiction, the isolation increases. And that's also true with older adults. But then sometimes people say, well, it's about aging. Or sometimes families get lost in the myth, well, they're getting older, they should have a pleasure in life. Well, the one thing we know about addiction is that it ages people much faster than they need to know to age. And, of course, as you know, recovery helps people keep that vitality of life. Some families find it very energy draining, you know, trying to keep mom off her pills and stuff. And there was a recent movie out with, I can't remember who was in it, but it was very, very powerful, where the family had just about had it with mom and her pills and, you know, they went through the house and they took all the pills. Well, I wouldn't recommend that, because with older adults, you also have huge detox needs, and detox is very different, and you need people that really specialize and really get that, yep, detox is going to be a little slower, treatment's going to be a little slower, but the recovery rates, particularly with the traditionalist generation, are very high because they follow the rules. So if they're told to go see the doctor and get rid of this, and they're the ones that they just love AA once they get involved in it. Now, it's quite a process to get them involved, but that whole getting a purpose back in life can be really powerful for people.
Yeah, and you said, I mean, when an older person, when they show signs of having a problem with alcohol prescription drugs, it's hard for most people to know what to do or what to say. You mentioned the family going through the house and picking up all of mom's pills, probably not a good idea. What are some of those common misconceptions that may cause a family member or person not to confront an older person who they might be concerned about? An example that you gave that I thought was great is, oh, they're in their glory days. They should be able to do whatever they want to do. That's, mm-hmm. I would think that that's mm-hmm. a common one. How do you even begin to get around that, or to kind of dispel that myth?
Well, and some of that is to start to educate, educate about, you know, that we see a lot of folks who are accidental addicts, that, you know, they didn't plan to go down this road, but the mixing of chemicals or the metabolism or the loss of structure, or it just kind of turned into a perfect storm. I mean, there's a lot of myths, and it's really good to point those out, because even as staff, we get into those myths, saying, you know, I've seen families say, well, it's temporary. You know, mom just had a broken hip. Well, mom's been going down for a long time, and she broke her hip because she was drunk and got up to go to the bathroom during the night and fell. Or they may say, well, it's like it's their last pleasure, or, well, the physician gives them those pills. I'm not a physician. I don't know what to do. She's too old to change. They may have the family sometimes, and, you know, the refuge does a great job in specializing with trauma. How does someone who's a trauma survivor confront a parent who's been their abuser, you know, many, many years ago, and do that kindly without shame? And, I mean, it gets really messy for people. There was a study out about, you know, a drink a day can be good for the heart. Well, people will use that. You know, I got to have my one drink a day. Well, a drink a day for a woman is very different than a drink a day for a young man. And a drink a day for an older person, particularly a woman, because women metabolize different, and then you add the aging, metabolize different. So it really can be really, really messy for folks and very difficult to sort through. You know, as a society, we tend to assess things based on how are people functioning socially. Well, these folks rarely are getting into legal trouble. You know, how are they doing with their work or their school? Well, a lot of times these folks aren't working. So what if you sleep in late, you know, in the morning and show up late for appointments? How are these folks doing with family relationships? Many times they're living alone. You know, they see family or talk to family occasionally, but so it's very difficult to sort out with older adults, is it a problem or not. Just recently, we had a gal come in, and she was obviously had a physical thing going on, and she was an older adult, and she said finally her friend said to her, enough, you're gone, you know. So a lot of times it might be the friends that are the ones that are going to intervene for folks.
I would think it'd be challenging from a treatment and addiction management standpoint, Brenda, that you have a population that might be dealing with some chronic pain issues. And
absolutely,
managing that has got to be a dance, a delicate dance between mm-hmm. managing the chronic pain issues with either non-narcotics or managing the addiction as well, so that person can be functioning. How do you do that? How do you even begin to do that?
Well,
or is that even an issue?
Your medical team is key. I mean, the medical folks are key in this, as are the psychological, as are the chemical dependency counselors, you know, working together as a team to first of all get the person detoxed. which might be a slower process. They may need a hospital-based detox versus a residential or an outpatient-based detox. And then starting to sort through. I mean, a lot of working with folks who are older is a lot of case management time, talking to the doctors, getting what we call a brown bag review together, asking folks to bring in all your pills, all your bottles, even my vitamins, yes, even my supplements, yes, so that a medical professional can start to look at that and start to pull it together. And also having, you know, after a while, they may need a pain specialist. I mean, sometimes, as you know, when people are detoxed and get off of chemicals, the rebound effect of the chemicals really does decrease the pain. But for other folks, there's legitimate things. There's people we've had having to leave treatment for surgery first because that's the priority. You know, they're in a really, really tough shape. We also use alternative methods such as, you know, referring for acupuncture, acupressure. We have a biofeedback bed, some breathing particular classes. Cognitive behavioral therapy is very effective with chronic pain, but that doesn't mean you still don't follow through with whatever the surgery is or whatever the medical procedure is and coordinating all that. But it's a great question. Also, one of the things that's different for the older folks might be keeping up with the schedule. You know, at Hazleton Naples, our schedule is from 8 in the morning. I mean, you're up, you need to be up and ready by 8 to go to groups and stuff till after 9 at night. So sometimes we may need to, with some folks, put right into their schedule, I don't want you to go to this lecture. I want you to rest during this time. Because older adults will follow those rules. But they'll also wear themselves out trying to keep up with other folks. So really looking at how do we individualize it for this person. And that takes special training and special passion, just like with young folks. You know, we all have, all the treatment centers have certain folks that just do so well with the young opiate addicts, as do we in Naples, Florida. But then there's also folks that we need that have a passion for people who are 50 and older. How is it different for boomers? It's very different for boomers than it is for 30-year-olds. How is it different for older adults? Very different. Is boomers and older adults different? You betcha they are. You betcha they are. And that's where we need the expertise. Just like Refuge has the expertise in trauma, at Hazleton Naples we have the expertise in what's the difference with these folks over 50.
Big difference, as you said. And I encourage individuals who are seeking help to try and find a treatment center that is right for him or her. For example, certain facilities that focus on treating specific age groups. Hazleton Naples, an amazing treatment facility. The Refuge as well, specializing in trauma. So if you're looking for help for yourself or someone you know, the Refuge has counselors available. Call Hazleton Naples as well. The important thing is that you take that...
6610.